Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Sea Control Podcast, hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security. My name is Matthew Marighi, and I'm your host for Sea Control North America. On this episode, we will be speaking with Molly Douglas, Rabia Alta, and Drew Yerkes, three graduate students at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, who are studying the Arctic. Our topics: the geopolitics of the Arctic, the economics of its natural resources, and the Arctic Circle Conference held annually in Iceland, which brings them all together. We will get started with this eye-opening interview in just a few minutes.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SIMSEC is, and always will be, free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There's a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SIMSEC article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SIMSEC is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
And we're back. As I mentioned before, I'm here with the members of the Arctic Conference at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy with Rabia, Molly, and Drew. So as is tradition at the Sea Control Podcast, please, everybody, introduce yourselves, and thank you very much again for being here with us today.
Good morning, Matt. Thanks so much for having us. My name is Rabia. I have about 8 years' experience working for the U.S. Department of Defense. I'm a second-year Master's of Arts in Law and Diplomacy student here at Fletcher, studying business and human security.
Hello, I'm Molly Douglas. I'm also a second-year student here at the Fletcher School studying business and energy policy. Prior to Fletcher, I worked for the Peace Corps, and I was a Peace Corps volunteer before that.
And where were you a Peace Corps volunteer?
Oh, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Albania in a rural mountain village.
A great maritime nation.
Woo-woo.
Hi, my name is Drew Yerkes, and I'm also a second-year Master's of Law and Diplomacy student at the Fletcher School. I'm currently studying development economics and conflict negotiation and conflict resolution. And before Fletcher, I was also a Peace Corps volunteer in East Java, Indonesia, in a small, like Mali, a small mountain village. And before that, I worked as an archaeologist for 4 years.
So you all have very diverse backgrounds and experiences. Even the double Peace Corps volunteers in mountain villages are still in very different parts of the world. So, but all of you have come together to work on the Fletcher Arctic Conference. And I was curious, what makes the Arctic so interesting right now that would draw all three of you from such different backgrounds into studying it? What's going on? I mean, what makes the Arctic such an exciting topic right now?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Arctic is sort of like the next frontier, I think a lot of people would say, in terms of both economic opportunity and also in terms of geopolitics. It's just a really exciting place to get involved.
I think part of the reason so many of us, even if we don't use this rationale at the forefront of our minds, as Molly mentioned, a new frontier in so many different aspects, whether that's economics, energy, geopolitics, security, business, public-private partnerships, I think we all see an opportunity to really put our expertise and knowledge to the best possible use to really prevent the Arctic from becoming the sort of morass that the rest of the world has become.
Now, obviously, this is a podcast for an institution of maritime security. Yeah. Security is such a big part of it. Yeah. So what kind of security challenges then are sort of like entwined in these, in the changes that are happening in the Arctic?
Well, I would say that one big thing is, especially with maritime, is border issues. I think one thing that, because the Arctic wasn't really focused on up until recently, up until the past 5-10 years, a lot of longstanding border conflict, not border conflicts, but territorial disputes weren't really solved, and no one had any intention to solve them, because really, who is focusing on the Arctic? So now you see movements by the United States, Canada, Denmark, through Greenland, Russia, Norway, a lot of different places, a lot of different nations, kind of pushing towards resolving their boundary disputes. That's like a number one, the baseline. But it's just interesting that in the Arctic, that hasn't even been figured out yet.
Absolutely. I would say that the security issues are intimately linked also with energy. Mm-hmm. We see with the science telling us and showing us that the Arctic ice is melting and we have much more access to the natural resources that are below the Arctic ice. What we're seeing right now is intimate link between energy policy and security. How exactly are the different Arctic nations planning on exploiting what's available there? And are they planning on exploiting the natural resources available? We're not sure.
And also, I mean, as resources become more available and as, you know, traffic is going to increase in the Arctic, there's also the element of security that, I don't know, pertains to sort of like search and rescue infrastructure, ensuring that increased activity is also safe activity to whatever extent possible.
So there's a lot of kind of sort of nesting and overlapping challenges. So, you know, you're mentioning security mm-hmm. at the same time you're talking about energy. You're talking about energy at the same time as infrastructure. It leads back into security.
Right.
So it seems like all of these things seem to be layered and linked with each other. So as far then as addressing those challenges, especially the territorial disputes and figuring out how infrastructure and security issues are going to work, are there any like forums where that's being talked about? Are countries paying enough attention to it now? Or is it still kind of amorphous and morass-like in terms of how it's evolving?
There's the Arctic Council, which is sort of the only governing body, so to speak, for the Arctic region. But it was developed to deal with sustainable development environment type of issues, not specifically security. But it is a really nice place to facilitate cooperation. And then I'd say also UN fora have also been in place where these things have been worked out or people are trying to work them out, especially with respect to territorial disputes.
Yeah, and as well, I mean, many of these issues have been worked bilaterally. For example, a project that I'm working on right now is about the Hans Island dispute in between Greenland and Canada. And it's, for the most part, it's just it's like good-natured kind of back and forth, tit for tat, this is our island, kind of one side says the same thing as the other. It just needs to, I feel like the pressure to solve it is more now.
Mm-hmm.
As in previously, there hasn't been as much pressure. Because I think there's a growing concern of other forces in the Arctic trying to take over land. And it's more about how the result of a small territorial dispute will be seen elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Absolutely. I'd just like to add that, you know, we sort of see the Arctic as this brand new frontier, but what's important to remember is that it is not ungoverned space. Every single part of the Arctic has, while there are border disputes, you know, governments have been present there for centuries. 80% of the land in the Arctic is either Canadian or Russian. And then, you know, the Scandinavian nations are the next 16% and so on and so forth. So certainly the, as my colleagues highlighted, the current fora, the UN, the Arctic Council, and then on a less official level, the Arctic Circle Assembly, are already important fora to discuss the larger issues. I think where there aren't as many opportunities to discuss Arctic issues might be with regards to security and defense specifically.
Mm-hmm.
NATO, I mean, almost all of the Arctic nations are NATO nations as well, with the one big exception of Russia. So another larger issue then is, do we need a new security forum to discuss issues regarding specifically weapons, defense, submarines, all this?
Mm-hmm.
We have the Coast Guard Forum, which is the Coast Guards of all 8 Arctic nations that have come together just recently in October of 2015. But there's a lot more to be done there. There's a lot more questions.
But it sets a nice precedent, you know?
Absolutely.
It's sort of like a nice neutral area in which most of the Arctic nations can come together and agree. Like search and rescue has been a place that it's been, I don't know, like an issue or a topic around which the nations seem to most readily develop agreements.
Mm-hmm.
So this is sort of maybe like a first step in mm-hmm. militaries coming together
mm-hmm.
in that direction of cooperation.
So there's some little breadcrumbs that are kind of getting dropped down to the area of security cooperation, but
sure.
still we
mm-hmm.
haven't gotten there yet. But one of the other arguments that I've heard as part of this sort of general sense of cooperation is that by not talking about security issues, that it's in some ways helped. helps because there's not a militarization of the Arctic. But then there are people that counter and say, well, mm-hmm. if you're not talking about it, those challenges, you know, they're not going to go away. It's just that you're not going to talk about them, and then something stupid's going to happen, mm-hmm. you know, because some strategic yeah. private somewhere makes right. a decision that's not very intelligent. yeah. So I was curious about, so if there's, you know, these little breadcrumbs that are getting dropped down. Mm-hmm. Do you see that security architecture evolving? And if it is, do you think that's a good thing?
I would say that the security architecture is evolving, and that likely the conversations about this are happening in the Arctic capitals, and we're likely just not privy to them right now. I will say that even though the Arctic has been a zone of cooperation across many, many fields, personally, and I'm not sure that my colleagues agree with me, the security aspect of the Arctic does still concern me, because a major player in the Arctic is Russia. This idea that somehow the Arctic is a place of cooperation and we're not going to take into account how Russia has been acting south of the Arctic Circle seems deeply naive to me. I mean, we have the Russian Defense Ministry themselves in late October confirmed that they are that it already has built a military base around the 80th parallel. And again, it's not a huge military base. It's one in which a company-sized element could thrive for about 18 months. So that's like about, you know, 80 to 150 soldiers, maybe up to 200. Not huge, and you're certainly not going to take over the Arctic with a company-sized element. But this is something to keep in mind. We can't simply gloss over this idea that it's all about cooperation. It is. We need to avoid militarization, but also take it with a grain of salt. We have an actor, Russia, whose economy is based on minerals. They want to get those natural resources to supplement their economy, especially with the way the economic sanctions are running right now.
Well, I mean, I don't think anybody is going to say that the Arctic is going to become Antarctica in the sense of, you know, that there's going to be some definitive cooperative, like, you know, this is going to be like a neutral zone forever and ever and ever. I don't think that at all. And I definitely think Russia has, there's been a lot of posturing. I mean, what was it, 2007? The planting of the Russian flag somewhat below the North Pole. I mean, that's pretty clear, you know, a little bit of like, hey guys, we're keeping it, you know, on the agenda. I think everybody just debates about like, how serious, is it a real threat? How serious of a threat? What does the posturing actually mean? Mm-hmm. What could we see it devolve into? Would it devolve into anything?
Yeah. And I think that so much press is put on the idea of conflict in the Arctic because the Arctic is a new sphere of just being on the global scale. So when you just read the kind of almost the same story over and over again, will there be conflict in the Arctic? Will there be conflict in the Arctic? And it's kind of like, well, give me some new information. Yes, Russia is posturing.
Absolutely.
And it's also because Russia is posturing that makes, you know, certain other elements in the Arctic posture as well. Like the United States is running military drills in the Arctic.
Right.
In areas where they've never done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, Norway shares a border with Russia, and they've always been, you know, deeply interested in what Russia is doing and very accepting of what Russia is doing. I think it's interesting. So much of the media that we read also thinks it's interesting, so they continue to write about it without really presenting new.
Yeah,
that's a really fair point. I mean, it's a conversation worth having, and we need to just find new information. We're not going. You can't really base what Russia or Norway is going to do just based on, say, military exercises. It's a lot more complicated than that. But again, a conversation worth having.
I think we see a lot more concrete things happen in terms of economic development in the Arctic, and we have a better idea of where nations are heading with respect to that. So, I don't know, maybe kind of tracing the way that economic projects develop alongside, like, supposed security agendas might be a better way of understanding where those security agendas will evolve.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit then, about the economic work that's being done in the Arctic. Obviously, I'm sure most people that are listening to the podcast are aware of the hydrocarbons and sort of the petrochemical resources. What are those like? And then what other kind of resources does the Arctic potentially offer? Since obviously with all the ice, it's kind of hard to figure out what's really under there. Why are people paying attention to those resources so, you know, so closely?
There's been a lot of fanfare around the possibility of shipping routes opening up through the Northern Sea Route and the Northwest Passage. But I think a lot of people are also dismissive about that, too. How soon will we have enough ice-free days for it to really become like a sustainable and economically feasible route? Will it ever be really economically feasible given the amount of infrastructure that needs to be put into place to support, you know, cargo ships moving along, the top of Russia over Canada. I mean, Russia is putting a lot of money into building its infrastructure along its northern coasts. Right now, they charge a really hefty fee for any ships that want to go through the northern sea route, and they offer them icebreaker escort. But they're looking into ways to making this sort of a more sustainable source of income for them, and they're also maintaining tight control over that route. There's a lot of debate about whether or not that's going to become really economically feasible, and if so, how soon would that be? I think people are also really interested in, as you were talking about, hydrocarbons and minerals. So, for example, we talk about the Greenland ice sheet and how it's kind of hit a tipping point and gone beyond it and is steadily, losing mass. And what could be below that ice sheet? Well, we know there are a lot of rare earth minerals there. And China, for example, is extremely interested in getting into that game. They even talked about at one point building like a giant airport in Greenland so that they could ship minerals out until, there were enough ice-free days to start shipping the minerals out. Just all different kinds of crazy ambitions.
I guess I would just second the thoughts on Greenland. I'd say that, we've seen Shell pull out. We've seen there's another large petrol company that pulled out of the Arctic recently, besides Shell. But as well, I think the rare earth minerals, just minerals in general, in Greenland is huge. I mean, many people thought that would help them stake a claim for being completely independent from Denmark. That's a very interesting debate that mm-hmm. we saw when we were in Iceland with the panels that we attended. But yeah, I mean, I'd say more so now because so many of those oil and gas companies have left the Arctic and don't necessarily seem like they're interested just because of the price of oil and various other reasons. I mean, it's incredibly dangerous. I mean, there might be oil, there might be gas, but I mean, just imagine an oil spill under a sheet of ice. How challenging is that going to be?
I mean, it's sort of orders of magnitude. You think about how complicated the BP oil spill, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico was, how difficult engineering surrounding that oil spill was. You put that under a mile of ice, mm-hmm. it becomes orders of magnitude more complicated. And I think what's also important to remember about the Arctic in general is that I believe it was one of the members of the World Wildlife Fund who spoke at the Arctic Circle Assembly in October. He said there is more than one future for the Arctic. It is not just a base for future resource extraction. And I think that's important to keep in mind when we talk about economic opportunities there. There are many Alaska Native corporations in, northern Alaska that are doing some incredible things, as well as the native peoples in northern Scandinavia and in Norway, Sweden, and Finland. And Russia has actually a huge native population. So when we talk about economic opportunities, I think it's also important to highlight the native efforts and also what's being done to protect their interests.
I think a lot of people sort of reduce this question of sustainable economic development or sustainable development down to relationships between indigenous peoples and the environment. Yeah. And kind of reduce it to that and don't have a more dynamic conversation about how indigenous populations, communities engage with economic opportunity as it's presented to them or as they discover it themselves, what opportunities there are for traditional knowledge. They can seriously make a buck. But also I think the fact that a lot of maritime powers around the world are very interested in still maintaining, a share of Like, let's say that the shipping routes do explode, right? Mm-hmm. So countries that have a lot of maritime expertise, I'm sorry?
Not literally.
Excuse me, Rabia.
One hopes not.
Rabia is our resident security expert. So I need to be careful with my language. But Korea, Singapore, Japan, there are a multitude of countries that still want to be heavily involved should some of the world's cargo ships suddenly shift their trajectory up over the Arctic.
That's a very solid point. Mm-hmm. Everybody, when they're talking about the Arctic, even like when we were starting this podcast off, mm-hmm. it's always about, Norway. It's always about Russia and China mm-hmm. or about the United States and Canada. Mm-hmm. But not a lot of people talk about, China and Korea, Japan, Singapore, and mm-hmm. Other countries that have significant stakes in the Arctic, even if they're actually a significant distance away. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it really is an international phenomenon. I mm-hmm. think it's good that we finally have people looking at that. Mm-hmm. So since it is an international phenomenon, and since you all went to Iceland and got to experience some of the zaniness that is Arctic Circle and its myriad people that go, not a lot of people, though, know that Arctic Circle is a thing. So I was wondering if you guys could walk us through what Arctic Circle is, when it happens, and what kind of people and places, sort of show up.
The Arctic Circle is an organization. It's in Iceland. The current president of Iceland, President Grimsson, founded it. And it's sort of a platform for bringing together governments, businesses, environmentalists, scientists, everybody you can imagine who would be interested in the Arctic and is currently working on the Arctic, into a space where they can have dynamic conversations about work being done, opportunities, and then sort of create partnerships, come together and collaborate through this huge information sharing kind of forum. It's a great place for diplomacy too. What happens is the Arctic Circle organization holds these assemblies throughout the year. And there's like big assembly and then there are like smaller gatherings and they're dispersed around the world. And I think also, I mean, there are a number of other entities that are heavily involved in it, not just Iceland as the primary driver behind like the agenda and where it's held and whatnot. Like Alice Rogoff, who's the publisher of the Alaska Dispatch News, is heavily involved, for example. And the way that they facilitate is pretty cool. So they'll have like an open call for people who are interested in doing sessions and they'll just ask for proposals. And so all these proposals will come flooding in and then a series of board members will assess kind of those proposals and decide what things are going to take the stage, so to speak. And there are all different kinds of sessions. You guys want to talk about it?
The thing that I thought was so cool about this past conference was just the demonstration of interest by so many different governments in the Arctic. I was surprised when I saw panel sessions put on by Brazil or South Korea or Scotland, for that matter.
Woohoo!
I mean, it was really cool. I mean, like Matt, like you said, like, oh, we hear about, you know, Norway, Russia, United States, Canada having these direct interests. But I think the world, in some regard, many other nations outside of the Arctic are really switching their gaze, if you would. Like, they're starting to look at the Arctic. And so panels, like, for example, panels, of course, like mining in Greenland, put on by multiple Danish mining companies, or you talk about food, sustainable food in the Arctic. They had, like, the Nordic Council come speak about what they're doing. You know, the Arctic Circle is one of the larger organizations that convenes these big meetings. But then there's, of course, many smaller organizations that are much more regional. So we have the Nordic Council, There's quite a few, and they're all there presenting on what they did. But I mean, just to have more than a thousand people.
You have sort of a mix of business, the regional organizations that Drew talked about. So the Nordic Council, you have the New England Ocean Cluster House,
which is still developing. But
still developing. You have people advocating public-private partnerships. You have the extractive resources companies, mining companies, gas and oil, people representing the native peoples and corporations and interests. I mean, it's a way to make the conversation larger and include more people.
Yeah.
And it's just fascinating, and it goes from theoretical to practical very quickly.
And, I mean, it's a huge cultural space, which is really cool. And it ranges from panel format where people are, this is the work that we're doing, to workshops where people convene stakeholders from all over the world to talk about challenges in the Arctic, as specific as infrastructure development in Greenland. How can we do it sustainably and better engage with, you know, the government of Greenland to make this effective, to something much bigger about, you know, is it really worth pursuing hydrocarbons in the Arctic? Should we back off altogether? It's also a great opportunity for people who are, I mean, you have foreign ministers who come and work and talk in the same space as master's and PhD candidates. So it's also really cool in that respect. A lot of people can share and engage with one another. It's a good space for that. And it's also sort of like a more neutral space than any other kind of forum. So in that sense, people are probably a lot more freer in their information sharing and in their kind of brainstorming together, I think.
Is there sort of like a fraternal element almost to it? Like, you know, even though they're people with like very different interests, the fact that it is kind of an open forum, does that make people a little bit more relaxed with each other? Or do you notice that there's still kind of like, you know, tensions between the different groups?
I think it's more friendly. Like I was in a session, I think Rabia was too, where our own Professor Muma was speaking. There was a representative from Statoil. There were other industry representatives. Fran Ulmer was on that panel. And they were having just this really lively debate. And they refer to all of, you know, one another by their first names and, you know, are making jokes and are expressing their frustrations loudly and publicly and just have a really productive conversation. And I don't know where else you see that. There's a lack of ceremony attached to this.
Yeah.
And a huge degree of accessibility. And I think people are a little bit more free with their exchanges.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I don't know that I went to one person and chatted with them and, you know, had them sort of pulled back a little bit. Everyone was really excited to meet one another. They didn't care what your sort of status was, whether you were a CEO or the secretary to the CEO, who is very powerful, by the way. you know, I would just introduce myself as a student, giving no background about myself. And I had the high-level people from Statoil and all these other organizations thrilled to talk with me and interested in chatting. And I've kept up several professional relationships with people that I've met at the Arctic Circle Assembly. I mean, it was really just an informal forum that created so much goodwill.
Yeah, it's a place for like innovation, entrepreneurship.
Absolutely.
Well, and we saw that so well on our first day when we first arrived in Iceland. We went basically directly from the airport to Reykjavik University, and we had the Fletcher School has a great connection with the Reykjavik University. And so one of the most memorable panels that I saw was we had one of our own Fletcher professors, Paul Berkman, leading a panel full, I think it was like 5 ambassadors to Iceland from 5 different countries. I think it was like Russia, United States, China, Norway, and then the foreign minister for Greenland. Deputy foreign minister for Greenland, mm-hmm. Kaja Holsen.
Kaja Holst Andersen.
It was just fascinating. It was great, that all those people were in the same place at one time, and that we were watching them talk about the importance of the Arctic. And granted, part of me is thinking, do people really need to explain why the Arctic is important? But at the same time, it was really interesting to see their background. And for each country, for China to be in the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
China really wants to be in the conversation, so why not? They have observer status in the Arctic Council.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense. I mean, they recently built a new embassy in Iceland, and it's the second largest foreign embassy on Iceland,
mm-hmm.
Behind the United States. Our hotel that we were staying in was right next to it. So we walked by it every day.
It was a pretty nice building.
It was a really nice, impressive building. Yeah. Very stoic.
very Scandinavian.
Yeah, very Scandinavian. Absolutely. Yeah, very modern. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it really struck home that there are a lot of opportunities that people want in the Arctic. So,
what China focused on, their presentation focused on the northern shipping route, from how I understand it, the route above Russia that would get them to, I can't remember if it was Stavanger, Norway, somewhere in Norway. And they actually said, State of China said that the ship that they sent north of Russia took 34 less days than going around their traditional route. 34 less days.
Wow.
So they had some pretty significant business ventures, pretty significant policy stuff that they were talking about. They weren't just there talking about how they'd like to be part of the conversation. They were demonstrating how they have acted in concert with their business community with regards to the Arctic. They're not just talking about it. They're doing it. They're, mm-hmm. they're part of it. We can't, I think, talk anymore about, letting China into the circle. They're already there.
Mm-hmm.
They're already there.
And already making contributions, or at the very least having substantive things to bring to the table.
Absolutely.
Yeah, a lot of investment in research and development. And I think mm-hmm. they had a representative in their plenary session who talked about their participation in the Yamal LNG project as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm.
But also they spent a lot of time in their plenary session talking about sort of their research and work into environmental sustainability and the science of what they were doing. Like, they were clearly also making sort of like a diplomatic overture and saying they were using it as an opportunity, I think, to say, we're not just there to go and pull stuff out of the ground and then exit. We're investing in these other elements as well and sort of demonstrating like we are like you in the way that we're looking at Arctic and Arctic economic opportunity. So, I don't know, that just seemed like a very clear point they were trying to make in their plenary session.
All right. Well, I guess I think we're probably approaching towards the end of the podcast. As is tradition, we'll end the podcast. We ask our panelists, what sorts of things then would you recommend people start reading or paying attention to if they want to educate themselves a little bit more about the Arctic?
My favorite is the Barents Observer.
What is the Barents Observer?
The Barents Observer is, I think it's based in either Tromsø, Norway. I think it's somewhere in northern Norway. And it's they talk about the Barents Sea. So the Barents Sea region is the part of the Arctic that's above Scandinavia, Kola Peninsula area around Svalbard. And so it's really interesting because historically it's always been a fascinating part, the only border between a NATO country and Russia throughout the Cold War. And so there's always been intrigue. Now, of course, for the past 10 years, that's been very peaceful. But I think the Barents Observer is documenting what's going on as far as the remilitarization of Scandinavia and Russia's borders.
My recommendation, if you just sort of want a little bit of basics on some of the security issues in the Arctic and a foundation for understanding it, would be the Center for Strategic and International Studies Europe program. They have a report called The New Ice Curtain, Russia's Strategic Reach to the Arctic. It was published in August of this year. It sort of covers the history of Russia's reach into the Arctic, perhaps what it might start looking like in the future, and connects it to the current policy of President Putin and his current approach to foreign policy in general.
I think in terms of sort of like a broad contextual knowledge for the Arctic, that's also really fun to read because it's so beautifully written, is Drew and I read this for a class last year, and I had read it the summer before coming to Fletcher, and I was like, oh, hey, it's on one of my syllabi, is Barry Lopez's Arctic Dreams, which is just beautifully written. It's fun to read. It's a really good way to sort of get up to speed on all of the issues. And I think in terms of news, Barents Observer is a lot of fun to read. And then there are just a bunch of like smaller regional media outlets or news sources that are fun to mine. Radio Canada International's Eye on the Arctic. And I think Alaska Dispatch News has the Arctic Wire, which synthesizes pertinent articles. There's Norwegian Trends. And there's an upcoming sort of like North Atlantic cultural magazine called Jewels of the North Atlantic. For sort of like the U.S. perspective also, Maine is making a lot of headway into the Arctic, and that's sort of like one of my personal huge interests. And if you pay attention to some of the Maine local news even, so like Maine Biz and then also the Portland Press Herald, a lot of really interesting things that are happening.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I guess also, this is also the perfect time, I think, to talk, for just a brief moment about the Fletcher Arctic Conference that you guys are all working on. Because hopefully some of our American listeners, or international, if they decide to take a flight out to scenic Medford, Massachusetts, will want to try to come. Could you tell the audience a little bit about what's going to be going on there and what kind of things you guys are working on?
Yeah. So the Fletcher Opening Arctic Conference, Opening Arctic 5, because it's the fifth iteration of the Arctic Conference at Fletcher, will take place on March 12th, 2016.
So we're going to be focusing more on sort of the geopolitical, security, and business aspects of the Arctic this particular year, because in the past we've had more of an emphasis sort of on the environmental aspects of the Arctic, and we're an interdisciplinary institution, and we are interdisciplinary people, and therefore our conference is interdisciplinary. So So I think like environmental and human sustainability are a huge part of this year's conference, but we're just sort of elevating the topics of security, geopolitics, and business. So we're going to have three panels that are going to revolve around geopolitics and security in the Arctic, entrepreneurship, business, and innovation, and then also sort of holistic approaches to Arctic infrastructure, which entails a little bit of governance as well as physical infrastructure and ways to collaborate and cooperate. And then we're going to have a series of breakout sessions in the afternoon, which will revolve around topics like Maine's engagement in the Arctic and what are all the dynamic, exciting things that they're doing. Also highlighting student research. We're hoping to get contributions from people all over the world, not just the Boston area. And the list goes on. It'll be a great networking opportunity. It's a good opportunity for students to really engage. We're making sure that that's a big part of this year's conference, that students really have a platform to learn and also contribute.
Yeah, we have the governments of Canada and Quebec on board as co-sponsors this year, and we're still looking for more participation from Arctic and non-Arctic nations. We also have confirmed coming to the event Ambassador Mark Brzezinski, who is the Executive Director of the Arctic Executive Steering Committee. Mm-hmm. With him coming, we're going to be very, very excited to really elevate the level of the conference and make sure that people in the Boston area and all over the country and world know Fletcher as a sort of center for Arctic studies. We're really excited about it.
Well, it sounds like a really interesting event, and I'm personally looking forward to attending it myself.
And if you are interested in finding more information about the conference, you should definitely follow us on Twitter at Fletcher Arctic. So FletcherArctic. And also we have a Facebook page, Arctic Fletcher. So we are on social media. You can check us out on our Tufts website as well, our Fletcher website. So.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, thank you again, all three of you, for coming out and joining us today and sharing with us, you know, some information on this very dynamic and exciting region. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.